Hello, you. This is the BBC Inside Science podcast, and I'm Adam Rutherford. Terms and conditions, and a joke about fractals at bbc.co.uk/radio4. Does anyone actually read them? Go on, you go and read them now. We're exploring strange new worlds today as our tally of exoplanets tops 1,000. I visit the crack team of undergraduate synthetic biologists who are using genetically modified bacteria to turn your rubbish into plastic. And you'll get to hear them for real at the top of the hour, as we say in Radioland. But earlier today, I visited the atomic clock that supplies the most iconic of Radio 4 sounds, the pips. Hello, we're exploring strange new worlds today as our tally on exoplanets tops 1,000. I visit the crack team of undergraduate synthetic biologists who are using genetically modified bacteria to turn your rubbish into plastic. And you'll get to hear them for real at the top of the hour, as we say in Radioland. But earlier today, I visited the atomic clock that supplies the most iconic of Radio 4 sounds, the pips. But first, on Monday, Ed Davy, Secretary of State for Energy and Climate Change, announced a deal with the French energy company EDF to build a new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point in Somerset.
The agreement today is a demonstration of the government's commitment to a new fleet of nuclear power stations, to replace those due to close, and to protect Britain's future energy security.
Hinkley C will be the first new plant to be commissioned in almost 20 years. Technology bounds on, so how different will it be in design from the bulk of our ageing reactor fleet? And how will radioactive waste produced there be dealt with? I spoke to Professor Sue Ian, former Director of Technology at British Nuclear Fuels and the Chair of the European Commission's Science and Technology Committee, Euratom. I started by asking her what type of reactor Hinkley C is going to be.
There are only really two basic designs available that are widespread across the international community. One sort is the pressurised water reactor type, and the other sort is the boiling water reactor type. It works much like a kettle. So water coolant has been used for many years now in the majority of the world's nuclear fleet.
So it's been used for many years. And the Prime Minister on Monday, he said, the quote was, "our determination to embrace new technologies and back new energy sources." So what is new about it?
They're part of a design called the Generation 3 Plus designs. I mean, light water reactors have been around since the late 1940s, early 1950s, when they were first used to power submarines and then were developed to become sources of electricity. So they've evolved over a number of years, and Sizewell B, which is one that we already have, would be a Generation 3 design. So the EPR, the European Pressurised Water Reactor that's going to go at Hinkley, is a modern evolution of that type of design.
One of the big issues with nuclear power is what we do with the waste. There's low, intermediate and high-level waste. The waste created by Hinkley C, how will we dispose of that?
For starts, one thing to try and get across is the fact that there's much less waste created by modern light water reactors than there was with our historic gas-cooled reactor types. For instance, the pressure vessel at Hinkley, it's only 5 metres, just under 5 metres in diameter. So that's tiny. And we get 1,600 megawatts of power out of something that's only 15 feet in diameter.
Well, smaller than this
which
studio,
is smaller than the studio that we're in, yeah. So it's an incredibly dense source of electricity for us. So the waste volumes are much, much smaller in this type of reactor than they are in traditional, more traditional gas-cooled reactors.
But where's it going to go, though?
Well, the vessel itself will be decontaminated and then cut up and packaged into concrete for disposal in the ILW repository that will be eventually built here in the UK. And most of the rest of the ILW that's created in the course of reactor operations will be packaged in concrete containers, or concrete in steel containers, again, for destination to the repository.
Well, we do have quite a big legacy of nuclear waste, though, in this country. How large is the stockpile? How much is Hinkley C going to contribute to that?
Hinkley C will only contribute a tiny amount to that. If we replace the whole of the nuclear fleet in the UK, it was only going to add 10% to the overall waste inventory that we already have. So Hinkley's only going to contribute 1% to 3% of that total. Most of the legacy, we've got to remember, was generated partly as a result of the military programme back in the early days of nuclear energy and in development of the early prototype reprocessing plants and the reactors themselves, and the choice of Magnox, which needs reprocessing, as a fuel for our early type of reactors. So nearly all the legacy is attributable to those early years.
So you mentioned the geological repository, but we don't really have concrete plans for that yet. We don't know where it's going to be built.
That's true. So during the course of the reactor operations, which will last up to 60 years, all the wastes generated, intermediate level waste, will be stored on site in an engineered store. And LLW, that's low-level waste that's created, will go, as it always has done from UK nuclear power stations, to the national low-level site up at Drigg in Cumbria.
And what about the high-level waste? So that's things like the spent fuel rods. They're highly radioactive. What are the plans for storing them?
Well, spent fuel rods will be stored on site for the duration of the reactor operations. So they'll be on site for 60 years in the spent fuel storage pool.
What's the timescale on establishing the geological repository? How long have we got to sort this out?
The original expectation was that the geological repository would actually be available, you know, by now. But of course, one of the things that the government decided to do, which is in common with international best practice, is to make sure that the community that was going to host the geological repository actually was happy to have it hosted there in their community. And so we still got quite a long way to go to get public acceptance of a site for a geological repository.
Dame Sue Ian, inside science at bbc.co.uk is the email address for splenetic venting, or on Twitter, the hashtag is inside science. Now, it's our regular equipment fetish corner, show us your instrument. And this one is wrapped up in BBC history. The clocks go back this weekend, or is it forward? I can never get that right. How do we know that your watch and my watch are telling the same time? The answers took shape at that hub of timekeeping, the Royal Observatory in Greenwich.
I'm Dr. Marek Kakula, and I'm the public astronomer at the Royal Observatory here in Greenwich. This is the original 6-pip master clock here at the Greenwich Observatory. It was used in the 1920s to send the time signals down a telephone line.
This is 2LO, the London station of the British Broadcasting Company calling.
To the BBC at Broadcasting House, and then transmitted to the whole country over the radio. The Royal Observatory was founded in the 17th century to make accurate maps of the stars, which could be used for navigation. But in order to make accurate positional measurements, you needed accurate time measurements. And so right from the very beginning of the observatory, position and time and astronomy were all linked together. So that's why the observatory became not only the site of the prime meridian, which is the zero point for longitude for the whole world, but also the basis for the world's time measurement and time zone system. Accurate measures of time have always been important, and as society has become more technological and more sophisticated, that importance of timing has grown and grown. So back before the days of the railway, different towns around the United Kingdom would have their own local time depending on where the sun was, which depends on your longitude, east or west. But of course, once you have the railways and you have rapid transit between destinations, you need to know when the trains are going to set off and when they're going to arrive. So you need timetables, and then you need to know, well, is this timetable telling me the arrival time in London time or Bristol time or whatever? So there was this imperative then to give the whole country one time, and that was the time defined by the sun here in Greenwich, Greenwich Mean Time. The pips don't come from Greenwich anymore. In the middle of the 20th century, most of the functions of the Greenwich Observatory were moved out to Hurstmonceux in the countryside. And then after that, the pips were transferred to the National Physical Laboratory in Teddington, where their controlled UK time is measured by their set of atomic clocks very, very accurately. And I believe there's an atomic clock synchronised with the Teddington clocks down in the basement of Broadcasting House. The pips in their heyday were really a very accurate way of getting the time out to people. The signal was sent down a telephone line, which takes a very small but measurable amount of time, and then broadcast via radio, so travelling at the speed of light around the country. These days, with digital radio, I'm sure many people are aware that there can sometimes be a delay between the digital and the FM radio signals, the sound coming out of your radio. So actually, that does pose a problem for conveying accurate time via the radio, because there is this delay, and that will vary depending on where you are and what kind of radio set you're using.
Down.
That was Marek Kakula, the public astronomer, showing us the original six-pip master clock at the Greenwich Observatory. Now, my ears pricked when Marek mentioned an atomic clock right here in the basement of Broadcasting House. So, as you can hear, I'm in the lift going down below Regent Street to level -2 to meet Ross Thompson, a true BBC Time Lord. His job title is Master Control Room Team Leader.
Door opening.
Hello, Ross.
Hello, Adam.
So behind this door, we actually have BBC time.
We do indeed, yes. We're about to enter one of our basement apparatus rooms, and we'll have a look at our rubidium clock.
There are a lot of warnings on this door. No smoking, no drinking, no eating, laser hazard, mind your head, noise level.
That's correct. Now, unfortunately, this room is rather noisy, so and also rather cold, so we will have to be a little brief, perhaps, in here.
Oh, God, it really is. It's really brisk in here. Why is it so cold?
We've got bays and bays of equipment in here, all generating heat, and we have to keep the air conditioning running to keep that equipment cool. Now, we'll try and find our rubidium clock. Unfortunately, we have to get even nearer to the air conditioning for that. And here we are.
So we're in this corridor, in this very noisy air-conditioned room, and there's banks and banks of computer equipment, but this one here, it looks kind of mundane, but I'm incredibly excited by this. This is what generates BBC time.
So this is what's generating BBC time. It doesn't look like a clock, as you'd understand it. It's just a grey box with a small LCD panel on the front, which is telling you the time, and it is receiving a very accurate time reference from the GPS, the global positioning system that you have in your car. It also receives a backup time reference from what we call MSF, which is a time code signal generated in this country. It's transmitted from Antorn, and it uses a cesium clock, which is run by the National Physical Laboratory to keep it accurate. So we use that clock and the GPS clock to keep our already very accurate clock even more accurate.
So, Ross, this is the clock that generates BBC time, but where are the pips kept?
OK, so one of the signals from this clock goes to another grey box in a nearby bay, which we can go and have a look at, and that's the box that actually makes the audio that you hear on the radio at the top of the hour. Now, here's the other box. Now, I'm afraid it looks very similar to the box we've been looking at, but the insides of it are quite different. So this box is receiving a time signal from our master clock, and this is the box that actually generates the bursts of audio, so the five short and the one long pip that you hear on the radio on the hour.
This is it. This is the actual pips. I can't tell you how exciting this is. We've been listening to this all my life, and this is it.
This is the actual pips. If you wish to switch it off, the pips will not be heard on Radio 4 at the next hour.
Yeah, well, obviously I won't do that, because civilization would collapse. It is actually a little bit cold in here and a little bit noisy. Shall we leave the pips to do their job?
I think that's a very good idea, yes.
OK, Ross, that's a bit warmer and a bit quieter too. So what happens this weekend when the clocks are due to go back?
Right, well, the atomic clock will just carry on running as it does now, but systems downstream of that know that there is an hour change coming up, and they will adjust automatically, which will be 2 o'clock BST, 1 o'clock GMT, and they'll all reset to normal, we hope.
Ross Thompson, master of the pips. You might think that we would play them now, but the rules are really strict about not playing the pips frivolously, for fear that confusion, anarchy and biblical chaos will ensue. So here is Ross's version.
That's
Now, that time on the rubidium atomic clock is Greenwich Mean Time, which, by some hangover from more imperial days, is also the default setting for what is known as Coordinated Universal Time, which means that if it's 4:45 in London, it's also 4:45 on Mars, or any of the 1,000 planets that we now know about outside of our own local neighbourhood. Yes, we passed a massive milestone this week in our exploration of the universe. The 1,000th extrasolar planet was found, a mere 18 years after the very first.
Scientists searching for life elsewhere in the universe believe they may have made a breakthrough. Evidence of another planetary system similar to our own is being presented to a conference of astronomers in Italy.
That was the Interplanetary News on the 6th of October 1995, with the discovery of 51 Pegasi b. Here's the late Patrick Moore talking at the time about what this meant for finding life on strange new worlds.
Our Sun is one of 100,000 million stars in our galaxy alone, and we know of 1,000 million galaxies, and that's the only part of them. And I refuse to believe that our own perfectly ordinary, unimportant Sun is the only one to have an inhabited planet going around it. And I'm quite sure that life is widespread. But saying that's one thing, and proving it is quite another.
I'm joined by astronomer Dr. Stuart Clark. Stuart, how did they discover 51 Pegasi b, the very first exoplanet?
Her technique was extraordinary. It was a really exquisite measurement, essentially, of the colour of the star. So the gravity of the star pulls the planet into a large orbit around, and the gravity of the planet, which is much, much smaller, pulls back on the star, and that makes the star do this tiny little pirouette. And when the star is moving towards us in that pirouette, so it turns the light essentially a little bit bluer. When it's moving away from us, it turns the light a little bit redder. It's just the Doppler effect working for light. And the astronomers could measure that effect and use it to calculate the size of this Doppler wobble, they called it, and then infer the orbit and the mass of the planet that was pulling the star.
OK, so this week we've clocked up our 1,000th exoplanet, the 1,000th planet outside of the solar system. And that's just 18 years on from that first one, from that first Doppler wobble. What have the other techniques been? Are there any other ways we've discovered some of these 1,000 planets over the last 18 years?
Yes, a large number of these 1,000 have been found by a different technique called the transit technique. And this relies on the fact that some planets are going to orbit directly across the face of their star. And when they do that, they're going to block a tiny little bit of the light out from that star. And so if you constantly monitor the star field, so that you're looking at 100,000 stars, which is what the NASA space telescope Kepler did, then it's constantly looking. And when it sees these little dips, you can infer again that there's a planet around them.
It must be real needle in a haystack, though, because there are billions of stars, and if you look up at the night sky, they're a long way away. They're just dots. They're
like, yes.
So how are you actually looking at something that's going in front of the star? How big is that dot?
Yeah, in terms of, say, a planet the size of Jupiter, then that's about 1/10 the size of a star like the Sun. The precision at which the Kepler Space Telescope could measure the brightness of the star and the variation in the brightness of the star, it could get down to planets that were the size of Earth and smaller, in fact. And it could do that simply because it was in space. So from above the atmosphere, there's no blurring effect of the air, and so you can measure pin-sharp precision.
So we've got more than 1,000 planets that are not part of the solar system now. What do they look like? How similar are they to the Earth?
That's the big, big question. Because at the moment, we can just get bulk properties for them, their mass, sometimes their size. But knowing what their physical and chemical conditions are is largely a subject of speculation at the moment.
But we have found some of those 1,000 exoplanets. We have found some which are roughly the same size as Earth.
Yes.
What sort of numbers?
So there are 100 or so of planets that are about the size of Earth or so. And the trick is that you can then calculate a rough temperature for them based on how close they are to their star, what the kind of star is that they're orbiting around. And you can kind of infer some conditions. So there's a couple of planets that sound really, really freaky. There's one called Corot 7b that's a rocky planet that's very, very close to its star. And it's going to be so hot that it could even vaporize the rocks and give you these sort of strange silicon clouds that could even condense pebbles and rain stones from the sky. And of course, the planets that we're most interested in are trying to find ones that have atmospheres that resemble Earth, because Earth's atmosphere can't be explained with purely chemistry. The gases in the atmosphere are put there by life.
Is it the right approach to be looking for planets that look like ours? Why wouldn't we see life on planets that are radically different from Earth?
I think that's where the thinking is going at the moment, because in these 1,000 planets, although we have some planets that are about the size of the Earth, we have some other planets that appear as if they're in the what they call the habitable zone around the star, we just haven't seen another planet that looks like a twin to Earth, so the same size as the Earth, in the same sized orbit as Earth, around a sun-like star. In fact, what we're clearly seeing in this data is that the solar system, our solar system, is not a standard reference point at all. It's not an archetypal solar system. There's the configuration of planets and the arrangement of planets around other stars are all over the shop. So we're having to change our ideas, and instead of looking just for Earth's twin, we're having to ask wider questions about habitability and search a wider range of planets to see if they can be habitable as well.
Thanks to Stuart Clarke. Back to Earth now, but no less extraordinary. We've all heard of genetic engineering. Tinkering with and swapping around the DNA of various organisms has become the basis for pretty much every aspect of biology in the last few years. But genetic modification itself has evolved into a new discipline called synthetic biology. One of the key differences is that the pieces of DNA being swapped around are standardised, so it's much easier to design new genetic systems because they all fit together almost like flat-pack furniture, only much smaller. Nowhere is this better exemplified than at the International Genetically Engineered Machine Competition, or iGEM. The machines in question are living organisms that students have invented, and they compete with their creations, which are designed to tackle global problems like dementia or waste recycling. Paul Fremont, head of the Centre for Synthetic Biology and Innovation at Imperial College London and iGEM judge, explains more.
I mean, iGEM's a really interesting competition that's run throughout the world. And it's a competition where you get together undergraduate students for a summer and you explore the opportunities that synthetic biology offer by trying to engineer a living system to perform some function, some utility, some aspect which the students think up. So it starts as a sort of blank canvas. And the students are given the tools and the know-how, and they just sit around and they work out, well, what are they going to do? What are they going to engineer? What are they going to build?
The Imperial College team has made it through to the grand final held in Boston next week. I went to their labs to find out what the team has actually built.
I'm Gemma Pilcher. I'm a third-year biochemist, and I'm from the Imperial College iGEM team. So our project is called Plasticity.
Plasticity?
Plasticity, yeah.
OK.
And what we've done is we have taken this waste.
Okay, so this is a little plastic container which has what looks like a bunch of rubbish in it, like yes. Cushion stuffing.
Yes. So when all your rubbish goes to these recycling plants, all the valuable material is taken out that can be recycled. But then what's left is this non-recyclable mixed waste. So it's just shredded up for incineration.
And what is it? What does it consist of?
One third of it will be bits of petrochemical plastics, lots of fibrous stuff, and we've got bits of foam, you know, shreds of fabric there, bits of paper. So we thought this could be an opportunity here. So we're taking this stuff to make bioplastic from.
What's bioplastic?
Okay, so bioplastic, the one that we've made, is a polyester that's naturally made in certain types of bacteria.
So you're engineering a bacteria.
Yeah.
To produce a plastic. And how does that relate to this old cushion stuffing that you're getting from the recycling plant?
Yeah, so the plan is that our bugs to create enzymes to break down the petrochemical plastics of this waste. Mm-hmm. But then all that kind of, as we were talking about before, like the fibrous stuff, the bits of paper, the bits of foam, that can actually be used as a carbon source for the bacteria to grow on. And then from that, they can produce this stuff. So this is the plastic that we've actually extracted from the bacteria.
Right, so this is a tiny little test tube, which has got a little sort of smidgen, like a pinch of white. What is it? Well, what, can we open it? Can you get it out?
Let's try and get a little bit.
So it's just little fragments of solid plastic.
Yeah.
Yeah, look at that. It looks kind of a bit like a cornflake. But this, what you're saying is that this is a piece of plastic that has been made by the bacteria that you have engineered.
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Cool. Yes, it is quite cool. But also, what's even cooler... So this was the one that we've done initially from the native organism, but then we've also changed the DNA sequence slightly to make it better. So then we've made more.
Oh, there's a lot more here. So this is a much bigger tube, and it's sort of half filled. So it's, what is that, like a couple of cubic centimetres of smudgy plastic, I guess, is
it?
Yeah. So wait a minute. Now, just when you say you've engineered these bacteria, this is normally the stuff of... you know, really sophisticated labs, but you're saying you're undergraduates and you've done this.
Yeah.
So how does that work?
So if you think of it like Lego bricks, for example, the reason why it's doable in the iGEM competition is all the parts are standardised, so they all just fit together like Lego bricks. When you register for the iGEM competition, you get sent a kit of all the different DNA parts, and then you can just assemble the parts together as you see fit, as how you design.
Now, this is pretty high-spec genetic engineering, so I had to ask Professor Paul Fremont, is it wise to let undergraduates play around with this kind of technology?
I think it is, and the reason I say that is because part of the whole competition is a very important part called human practice. And what the students are trained in and to think about very early on in the project development is what the implications of what they're doing might be. Unusually, biologists and geneticists don't have any kind of, you know, ethical foundations for their work, surprisingly, whereas medics do and engineers do. But for some reason, biologists don't have this code of practice as part of their training, which is odd. But what iGEM does is it will bring that code of practice into play very early on in the student's education experience, actually.
So what is the overall point of iGEM?
I think iGEM is to... try and make people think about what if, what could you actually build? What sort of biological system could you build using sort of more engineering approaches? So it's very creative.
And the final word to Gemma. If this is a competition, what's the prize?
So the trophy is this big, what looks exactly like a Lego brick, and it's silvery and very pretty, but more just... that great sense of pride, I think, to have triumphed after, you know, what's been a very enjoyable but also very intense summer.
Gemma Pilcher from Imperial College London. Best of British to both them and the Dundee University iGEM team, who also made it to next week's Synthetic Biology Olympics. That's all for now. Lucy Green is holding the fort for the next couple of weeks. See you soon.